Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Entrepreneurism, Begin with the End in Mind. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine programs, events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. John Fisher is the author of the 2008 book, Strategic Entrepreneurism, Shattering the Startup Entrepreneurial Myths. Currently, he serves as an adjunct faculty member at the University of San Francisco's School of Business. An entrepreneurship aficionado, he is a media commentator and lectures frequently at university business schools. John was named Ernst & Young's 2007 Entrepreneur of the Year in California. He has served as CEO of three software companies in the Silicon Valley over the past 17 years. Among them is Barossa, Inc., which was acquired by Oracle. John writes for Sandhill.com and the Belvedere Tiburon Chamber of Commerce and is a trustee of the Nueva School, Buck Institute for Age Research, and the Foundation for Accelerated Vascular Research. Will you please join me in welcoming John Fisher?
Thank you very much for the nice introduction, Tom, and it's indeed an honor to be here at the Commonwealth Club of California. The California Institute of Technology released a study confirming why it's so difficult to swat a fly, and they got the whole process on tape using high-speed equipment, a fancy fly swatter. And it turns out that as we approach the insect, it can detect the threat, process it through its system, pivot its body and hind legs, and fly off in the opposite direction, all in approximately 200 milliseconds. That's faster than we humans can operate, and so we miss. So the study confirms if we want to be more successful, we should aim not at the fly's starting position, but in the path of its estimated escape route. Now, Caltech studies these things. It slows down a process we can't see, subjects it to quantifiable variables, in order that we all learn more about complex engineering, given the fly is still a bit of a mystery of aerodynamics. I study another complex and difficult to see process, this time in the form of leading a technology company, hopefully to successful acquisition before the team and I get smushed. And what happens in studying the variables that lead up to this process is you find out that the economy and the market are truly critical. You talk to a venture capitalist or a pure financier, and he may say, well, we bet on the jockey and not the horse, meaning that the team is the most important variable. And I think betting on a good team is critical. It makes everyone's life easier. And indeed, why not bet on a team or at least a good product and service? But it's also been said that a lousy market often defeats a great team. And a great market can enable even a lousy team to succeed. And even a mediocre team can sell a lousy product. So we're back to the market. So I've taken a close look at the stock market, the various housing starts, unemployment, a variety of criteria. And I've come up with an economic thesis that I think is an economic predictor that you probably haven't seen before because it's from an entrepreneur's vantage point. It's not a traditional economic analysis, and it's from an entrepreneur's forecasting methodology. And in taking a look at this, whether we're running our company to a conclusion, whether we're making an investment decision and seeing that to fruition, some people call this being in the right place at the right time. Others call it plainly being lucky. I'd like to think of it also as beginning with the end in mind. So I've written a book. To understand the economic thesis, one has to understand the entrepreneur's thesis in this case. I believe that we should all start our companies right from inception or as soon as possible with the notion that there's a likely cross-section of potential acquirers for that company. So we're here and we're looking at maybe 6 or 12 companies down the road that are here. And what can we do deliberately, gently, to sculpt our company to better appeal to them, to run our company in their direction. We can do this technologically. We can do this operationally. And by the way, most important, financially. We should keep control of our company, the management team, and me. We should be able to approve our own destiny so when the right time and place per se manifests, or if we just are getting plumb tired, we can approve our own merger, which I think is a lot about being an entrepreneur to begin with. So this philosophy of beginning with the end in mind, of running a company to a certain destiny, is the framework for this economic analysis. And here's why. When you're running a company, you tactically crunch all of this information. You're running quarter to quarter. You are consumed with the day to day and the quarter to quarter. When you are often making economic analysis, you're doing the same thing. You're crunching data and you're extrapolating, and then you're making a forecast based on the data that you have in front of you. What if instead, just like the entrepreneur looking for the event on the horizon, what if we merely hypothesize what the economy, for example, is going to look like a year from now or 2 years from now, and then we search for what criteria or what information need exist or has existed historically to support that hypothesis? Now, we can't control what an acquirer does any more than we can control what the economy does. And I'm not trying to describe any false science or data manipulation. While I manipulate a company, you can't manipulate the data to support a hypothesis. But it causes one to look at data in a different way. Instead of, as I said, crunching everything in front of us, we are looking for what may exist to support a hypothesis. And so in thinking that way, strategically as an entrepreneur, and perhaps just keeping our head up a bit more as a traditional economist, I came up with something that that may interest you. This is a chart of national new housing starts and unemployment over the last severe recessions that we've had. We're here in the mid-70s, early 80s, early 90s, and I'll actually talk briefly to why I think the dot-com recession wasn't as bad as people thought. This plot of unemployment is here, this blue line that you can see zigzagging, and the plot of housing starts is here. The thesis is that housing starts and unemployment are inversely correlated in the U.S. and internationally. That is, as one goes up, the other goes down, and vice versa. What's interesting is I believe that big decreases in housing starts, like here and like here and like here, have framed the worst recessions that we've experienced. You notice that 2007 and 2009 isn't up yet. We'll talk about that in a moment as well. So first we get a gigantic decrease in new housing starts, and then we get a corresponding, I believe, increase in national unemployment. So in the first quarter of 2008, perhaps like many of you, I was very worried. I was looking at systemic damage and problems in the economy. I was trying to make sense of it all, and yet the national unemployment number was static. It was not moving at all. And because unemployment is a lagging indicator, I was waiting for it to go up and go up significantly, as it has all these times in the past, given systemic damage to the economy. So just like the entrepreneur's thesis, I'm saying half a dozen companies may look to buy me in the future. What if unemployment spiked to a level like this, 12%, or a level like this, 9%, a year from when I was analyzing this, which was the first quarter of 2008? If unemployment was going to do that by 2009, as it has, what needed to exist to precede that event? It may sound like the same data analysis, but I'm telling you, at least in my mind, it's different, because who the heck puts these two things together on a chart like this? At least I haven't seen it yet. These are two unrelated items. It's using the same time analysis. These are the number of housing starts. This is unemployment. So this is approximately 2.5 million units annualized per year. These are the time, as I said, and then this is approximately 10% unemployment here. So you put these things together, and then something jumps out at you. So in the early 70s, one of the worst, if not the worst recession we've had before the one that we're in, we have this big decrease in housing starts. Then unemployment spikes to this level. this pattern that we've experienced right here almost mirrors what we just went through in this last recession, presumably if we're out of the recession. So I found that housing starts indeed are the best, I think, predictor, at least that I found, of a corresponding spike in unemployment. And so I started studying this in more detail. You might say we've just gone through an unprecedented housing crunch, or you might say that something else was characterized by houses. In August of 1973, while we were doing about 2 million annualized units, this is the number of homes that we are starting construction on, we fell every single month until December of 1974. Every single month the housing starts decayed until we are at roughly 975,000 annualized units, or half the productivity. In January of 1974, roughly two quarters after the housing starts started to collapse, the Dow was still trading at a relatively stable 846 or 850 and change. And it wasn't until July of 1974 that the Dow collapsed and lost another 30% of its value. So the thesis is that housing starts not only signal the rise in unemployment, but that housing starts also are a better predictor of economic catastrophe than the stock market that's supposed to be this forward-looking vehicle, right? It's supposed to look out 6 months. Well, look what happened here. It was 6 months late. And again, the thesis is that when you have this kind of decline in the housing starts, it's indicative of systemic economic problems. It's not that you're just going down for no reason. Think about the number of services and commerce and thereabouts that flow into housing, from construction to refurbishing and refinishing to the wares that we put in our homes. So this is a big deal when a relatively efficient market chooses to half itself. And it's a very big deal when it chooses to do so virtually unnoticed by this forward-looking mechanism like a stock market. Now coming up to present day. In January 2006, we were at basically the same level of productivity, 2 million annualized units and change. People are smiling. It's not that funny, you know, if you went through it. We all did. In July of 2007, we basically halved our productivity again. People call this a housing bust, but the same thing happened in the 70s. Now look at the stock market. This time, not just two quarters behind, it took a year and a half for the stock market to notice. In July of 2007, we were trading at the still at the high at 14,000. And then it wasn't until March of 2009 that we more than lost half of our value. So we saw a gigantic decrease in these new housing starts over a long time, and it's debatable whether we've even reached a low as of today. I think actually we have. Before, again, this forward-looking instrument, the Dow, took notice. Now, I see at least one traditional economist who I know and respect. Now, he might say to us, and since we're live, I'll try to save myself from the Q&A. He might say, yeah, this is interesting, but the correlation is too loose to be quantifiably significant, right? It's not a strong economic premise by just putting these two things together. So I tried to take this a little further. First of all, this is the U.S. Data as of 2007 and 2009. If we go back to this chart that you saw before, I just want to make sure that I point out this phenomenon. This to me looks like a diamond. It's not shaped very well, but you can see it each time. Here in this recession, here in this recession, and here. The first part is the housing starts going down, unemployment going up. That makes half of the diamond, if you will. So I believe that this is, of course, the same half of the diamond, meaning this is the worst recession we've ever been in. Comparisons to the Great Depression I don't include here because of apples-to-apples population comparisons, right? Even in the mid-70s, the population was only two-thirds of what it is today. So I just go back to the 70s. Here's your half diamond as far as what's going on with housing starts getting their collapse here and then unemployment spiking like that. So the interesting thing as far as the past being the past
is what if, just as I think folks were wrong before about how quickly unemployment would spike, what if they're wrong now about how quickly it will peak and then decrease? This is just half of the cycle, and then the other half of the cycle is coming up. And the other half of the cycle shows, in every single case in these recessions, a sharp V-shaped recovery in these housing starts that almost precisely, remember, this is a graph over many years, matches up with a corresponding peak and then decrease in unemployment. That's the definition of an inverse correlation. Remember, up one, down the other. So what if here we are poised to see, and the latest unemployment numbers coming out on Friday, what if we are poised to see national unemployment peak at about 10% and change and then go down by a significant amount over the next few quarters? And that's what I think is going to happen. Addressing the economist's problem with the correlation, I analyzed the G8 countries. Not only does this phenomenon exist in the U.S., but this is Canada's new housing starts and national unemployment. It looks exactly the same. Now, this is 2007, 2009. If you also go back in Canada's history, it looks exactly the same as far as these its previous recessions looking like our recessions and the dynamic that's described with the housing starts and unemployment. So it's happening abroad. It's also happening in Japan. I want to thank Kurt Christofferson, a hardcore engineer and ex-Oracle guy working with me, who crunched all this data down at Stanford, down at the University of San Francisco. And these are real numbers, of course, that we plugged into the model. The same phenomenon existing now. Now, you can say this, again, is a housing bust, and this is a housing-related phenomenon, and with the housing bust, you get corresponding unemployment. But this phenomenon exists in previous recessions as well in that country, as well as the United Kingdom. And what's interesting about the UK is this is less pronounced than the ones that you just saw, including the US. And what I think that means is that the UK really isn't out of the woods yet. It's still awful over there. And that's being reported, that they're still, you know, nearing the end of their cycle, where hopefully we have near the end of our cycle. So this diamond is not as pronounced, and perhaps unemployment there has a good deal more to travel. So I asked myself the question, what if the world isn't that flat? Friedman's thesis is everything is leveling off and there's an equal playing field. I sold a company to Oracle. I went to work for Oracle. They're one of the largest companies in the world. You get to see up close what a global organization does. I know a lot about HP. I know a lot about Cisco, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these guys are generating more than 50% of their revenue worldwide. So how can you not say the world is flat? The moment I saw the Netscape browser, one of Friedman's flatteners, I dropped out of college. So I believe that the world is supposed to be flat. Yet what if the American home, what if the international home is truly the center of things, right? What if these housing starts, the number of homes that we're building, really represent the center of the economy and not all of this technological infrastructure? I mean, think about it. The amount of money and work we put into our homes. It's not counterintuitive to think these have a lot more of the pulse of the economy than we're anticipating. My parents were able to send me to school through mortgage equity withdrawals starting in 1972. Those don't exist anymore. And that was the primary fuel for growth out of the home. And some people think that we're going to limp along like Japan did in the 90s because we don't have that growth. So the question is, what if the home is the center of the economy? Now, this is the actual Bloomberg workup that we did in April of 2008. Got to get some credibility going. And also, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. We've got to get some politics going. So this is the graph that we used, and we published a forecast. It's up here, and some Wall Street publications picked it up. In April of 2008, we forecasted that national unemployment, then at 5%, would rise to 9% by April of 2009. So that's perhaps a reason why the Commonwealth Club let us in the door. We missed by 0.1% over a year-long forecast. The politics comes in when I see the administration all over the airways. The vice president on down has been going on all of the national talk shows and saying, we forecasted only 2 quarters ago national unemployment peaking at 8%, stimulus and everything included. And you can't fault us for that because nobody got it right. So for the price of admission, ladies and gentlemen, you can go home and be licensed to now scream at the television like I do when you see these guys go live, because a few of us, just with some engineering resources, were able to at least call this what it was, a lagging indicator that was going to spike a lot more than we thought. And Dr. Summers was on Meet the Press just this last Sunday saying the same thing. Nobody got it right. Don't fault us. So the past is the past. That's fine. But then the question is, what's the future? And again, if housing starts have bottomed, as they did here in the mid-70s, as they did here in the early 80s, as they did here in the early 90s, et cetera, and by the way, this is exactly what I saw in April. You can just make it out that the Bloomberg thing printed out April of 08. The housing starts had only fallen to about the levels of the worst that we saw in the 70s, and since then they have gone to unprecedented, unholy levels. And look at national unemployment. It just started to uptick at that time, and now, of course, you can see the symmetries. Now, of course, it's here and higher as of Friday. What if, what if unemployment will peak and drop much more quickly than consensus estimates? Warren Buffett himself is saying that national unemployment will go to 11% and higher. If this thesis is right, it will not. I'm forecasting it will go to 10.4% and no higher and then drop. And it may not even hit that level. I try to apply this entrepreneur's thesis that admittedly is a bit opportunistic and a bit commerce-driven to the nonprofit world. I serve as a trustee of the Nueva School. It's a K-8 school in the Bay Area, years before my wife and I decided to expand our family. So I'm trying to get ahead of the curve in education. I serve on as a trustee of the Buck Institute for Age Research. I'm only 37. If I know I look a lot older than that, but hopefully I don't need the Buck Institute's services or my family quite yet. The Pacific Vascular Research Foundation is staffed by these world-class and founded by these world-class UCSF physicians. And so I have joined up in the hopes that we can defend my family against vascular disease. And all of the all of these processes, all of these pursuits are based on, again, trying to begin with the end in mind. This is the worst kind of end, and Steve Jobs talks about that we should all go for the gusto because we'll be dead soon. But this is certainly where I think time is well spent. Finally, I wanted to mention a company. My CFO is here, who's been with me in these last few ventures. And he has co-founded a company that is a social networking application called Linksify that is the opposite of these Facebooks and Twitters and thereabouts. And I think more people on my side of the fence should say publicly that I have no idea what these Facebook guys and other guys are doing. They have 400, 500 million users, and they're still not profitable. And remember, if we are looking... In their case, they're looking for an IPO. I don't do that because I don't think those are possible to do. But if they're looking for, you know, to build a more and more successful company, why not get profitable a little sooner? If Twitter is looking to build a successful company, and you may have just read in the news today that they're already being sued for patent infringement, and all of these social networking applications already have these technologies, why don't we monetize these things more quickly and get profitable more quickly? I think the Web 2.0 space is poised for a real problem, and the reason I'm mentioning in the context of this kind of discussion, where I'm really trying to study what is happening in the economy and contribute some analysis, is I think these Web 2.0 guys are poised to suck the oxygen out of the liquidity markets and hurt the clean tech guys. And that was forgivable during the dot-com days when the destruction of a dot-com company and another one would take its place. But we must have a Tesla. We must have these battery companies. We must have desalinization companies and whatever else is necessary to save the planet. And so I think it's a zero-sum game as far as the money available to companies these days. So I would like for the Web 2.0 guys to sell their company successfully, and I think they missed their window. Whether you subscribe to this thesis or not, I think they could have done very, very well 2 or 3 years ago, and it remains to be seen what's going to happen now. So Tony has started a company. The last reason I want to mention is I think he's starting at exactly the right time. I think in a quarter or two, the housing start wave that we have been talking to will form again, and all of the associated commerce with it. As a surfer, you look at a wave that starts to form. I think that starting a technology company, making a real estate investment, or seeing any kind of investment decision to fruition, not because of green shoots and not because of rhetoric, based on a quantifiable analysis, is going to make sense now and in the next quarters, provided that indeed we've reached that low in new housing starts. And that's what gets scary, because I think we are recovering. I think you've seen in the last few months data to support a rebound in housing starts. If we haven't recovered and it does go lower, then everything holds that the stock market will take another big correction, which is not what any of us want to see. Some people call this being in the right time at the right place. Tony and I, in our careers, occasionally have been at the right time at the right place. Have we been lucky? Thank you very much for listening. And if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to talk to them.
So we'll move into a period of questions. And John, maybe you could share a little bit about your own entrepreneurial experience with regard to, you had alluded to it at the start, and I guess your book goes into a little more about shattering some of the myths, and I'm sure a lot of people here came tonight to explore issues of applying entrepreneurship, if you will, at either the places they work or maybe in their own lives and so forth. But talk about a little bit about, if you would, your own experiences with regard to entrepreneurship and how you form some of your theories and how you actualize them.
I've led three companies in 17 years. The first one, and I think I was too young to know the difference. The second one did not. I think I was 6 to 12 months too late, and I'll never forget that experience. As far as doing everything possible and doing everything within our power to win, and you remember April of 2000 just like I did. I was sitting in a board meeting in March of 2000, and some very smart and capable and longtime successful entrepreneurs said, go increase the sales staff by 30% as soon as you possibly can. We're a first mover. We're doing everything right. And then in April of 2000, the same team came back and said, fire 30% of the company. And to see that kind of knee-jerk strategy, you start to think, oh, man, should we have been looking at different things all along rather than the tactical and related objectives? In this last company, it was internet security for banks. Kind of a nice space to be in, right? There was all this fraud. The banks were forced to upgrade. But we did and were conscious of starting a company at, we thought, the right time, and we were very careful about the financial engineering of the company. We only raised as much money as was necessary to accomplish a next milestone. And so we didn't suffer the dilution that some of these guys, I think, are suffering trying to build bigger and bigger companies. And so when the time came, when a few parties were interested and we were aggressive pursuing them, we were able, as I mentioned, to approve with majority control of the company a merger. And so many talented entrepreneurs that I'm dealing with these days are not able to approve that. They have obscure provisions in their documents, like every man gets a vote. So an investor who puts $75,000 into one of these things gets the same vote as I do leading these things. And they call up and they say, we can't get out, you know, and no one's here to help. You've got to make sure that you enter into the right financing conditions, I think, to begin with. So in my own career, I've been most cognizant of structuring a technology company financially, and then I think the team, and then I think the product or service. Now, when I say financially, that's the substitute for the economic thesis. Since I was much younger and I hadn't embraced the economic thesis, or I wasn't thinking about where I and the company fit in the world, if you will. It was the financial engineering to make sure that we kept tight ownership of the company that enabled us to survive.
What about the issue of the problem itself that you're trying to solve, whether it be a product or a service? I mean, you know, do people, you go out looking for a big problem to solve, or do you just taking a look at a small problem? Because, again, one of the theses I'd picked up from talking with you before and what you've shared tonight is that an entrepreneur should think more, at least my interpretation, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that to think more toward the short term. You're trying to build something in order to sell it, as opposed to the built to last, you know, the long term, so forth. So what about the nature of the issue that you're building a company around, and then this short term versus long term? If you'd elaborate a little bit on that.
Building a company for the short term, as I mentioned, sounds a bit opportunistic. I meet a lot of talented and younger people who are building something to try to change the world. And the only way that I know with a reasonable degree of accuracy to try to influence the world is to put a good product, a good team in the field, and then hand it to a great company and let them do the hard work. If you build your company and sell it to Oracle, and they're still doing a deal a month, and they're one of the most acquisitive companies out there, but Cisco, HP, Microsoft, all these guys, these are the new IPOs anyway. This is the way we get liquid. But if I'm talking to a younger student who wants to change the world, go put your wares in the likes of Oracle, for example, and watch what they can do. And it really is a rewarding experience on the commerce side or on the asset protection side. It's also the highest propensity way that I know that we can survive as entrepreneurs. We are a pretty darn efficient lobby. 9 out of 10 of us fail, or 97 out of 100 of us fail if you're talking about the failure to get a financing. So when we do survive, we are selected to survive, and so we're scratching and clawing looking for any piece of data that we can get our hands on to make ourselves competitive, perhaps more efficient than the housing market that I just got done saying is enormously efficient. So as an entrepreneur, the thesis goes that financially we design the company for that acquisition, and then the hand still goes up and the student says, well, everything you said, fine, I still want to be the next Steve Jobs or Larry Ellison. I say all power to you, just architect your company in this way, and then if you blow out expectations, you can just say no to any acquirer, to any financing, to anything you want. But if you don't architect your company this way, I think you wind up like a lot of these Web 2.0 guys are going to end up in the next couple of quarters, in the next couple of years.
Your premise on an economic recovery in a couple of quarters is based on a resumption of the housing industry. There are 5 million houses for sale in the United States right now. There are another 20 million which are underwater on their mortgage. Who's going to buy all these houses?
The government.
The government's going to start buying
No, that's my smart-ass remark. No, the government is not going to do that. But you're right. And we're seeing a lot of the churn activity coming from foreclosures, refinancing. So a lot of the green shoots, I think, that people are talking about are not real. But we've experienced unprecedented systemic decline. We're not building any homes. We're so far below the 900,000 units that we talked about in the early 70s. We're now at 500,000 units, and we're starting to climb, or we were a few months ago. So we are so low that I think given the inventory that you mentioned, it's coming down, and I think we are going to have an unprecedented boom of activity just based on what's happened historically. I can give you a lot of data to support why I think there are offsets to the inventory that you mentioned, but I think my answer to that is because of the decline that we've seen, I think the bounce back is going to be just as severe, and that will more than offset the inventory problems that you just mentioned.
Well, I asked the question because if you don't get a V-shaped recovery and a new housing boom, you have an L-shaped recovery, which means no recovery. That would suggest that now is a less than optimal time to start a new company. That is what happened in Japan for 20 years.
Exactly right. If it isn't a V-shaped recovery, the other end of the thesis doesn't hold, then I'm not invited back, then I'm wrong. But if it does, and it does recover the way it's recovered in these previous recessions, then it gets very interesting as far as timing this. Now, Japan, or I should say, the thesis does not hold for all recessions. It doesn't hold for the dot-com recession. Unemployment then, in the Bay Area, when all of the dot-coms were in the Bay Area, was still half of what it is now. And even nationally, it was half of what it is now. So I don't think the 2000-2001 recession was anywhere near as severe systemically as the 70s, 80s, 90s, and, of course, the one that we're in. So I believe, and when you mention Japan, there's also the anomaly that they failed to acknowledge anything for 10 years, and then you get another 10 years. And some people are saying that we'll limp along just like that because we have no fuel for growth. So there could be anomalies like the lack of mortgage equity withdrawals. We took $1 trillion out of our homes in 2005, reinvested, Greenspan estimates, $500 trillion in the economy. That's the equivalent of half a dozen of the current stimulus size spends, right? Because the whole stimulus doesn't equate to economic spend. So without that fuel, and we're at negative mortgage equity withdrawals for a time, how do you replace the growth? But if we do get the V-shaped and the unemployment does peak and decline much more quickly than anticipated or than consensus estimates, then, oh, wow, it's a contrarian view, but what an opportunity and certainly something to think about. Now, do I run a company by this? Let's be fair, no. But do I keep my head up so I don't get hit by a shovel because of this? Yes. Because I've seen too many much more talented and smart entrepreneurs than I get hit by that shovel because they can't push against the ocean when 2007, 2008 rolls around.
So let's talk a little more about your philosophy of entrepreneurship. Babson College, I think back in Massachusetts, is quite renowned for their entrepreneurship coursework. And I've always been intrigued by that. They say that entrepreneurship is first and foremost a mindset. That's opportunity obsessed, leadership balanced, and a couple of other things. But talk a little more about you've mentioned this financially architecting your company for this more short-term sale, the importance of the team, and so forth. But talk a little more about some of your philosophy or principles of entrepreneurship, and also if you can, how this might be applicable within existing organizations. I know years ago, decades ago, whatever they used to talk about. Entrepreneurship or something in existing corporations. So that issue of mindset always seems to intrigue me about the potential for that. But anyway, expound a little more, if you would, on your philosophy of entrepreneurship.
Sure. Entrepreneurship, the concept of being entrepreneurial within a large organization has merit. There are 27 million entrepreneurs in this country responsible for profit and loss. And there are many more employees in this country working for bigger companies that perhaps are entrepreneurial. By the way, there are already 27 million people on is it painkillers or some other drug that was just announced? We'll have to cross-reference who are the entrepreneurs and who are the people. I think antidepressants was the data. 27 million on antidepressants. So to be entrepreneurial within a big organization can be extremely rewarding, especially for the student these days where it's so difficult to start with the business in tough economic times. So it's a great place at a Google to get one's feet in gear before we go and start a company. That's the concept of the entrepreneurship. But to answer the question with the greatest respect to Babson, and I teach business school, don't go to business school to learn entrepreneurship. You solve a problem for a business or solve a problem for an entity that can pay you so that you can get to profitability and can and it's worth solving so that if you're not acquired, you don't exit your business. At the very least, you're running a robust enough organization. All the concepts of the traits of entrepreneurs and the data that goes into entrepreneurship. My three companies have been in three completely unrelated vertical markets. They had no rhyme or reason, no pattern to them. It was just solving a problem and then hopefully seeing a company to fruition. So when I do see these students in business school, they're trying to learn about balance sheets and they're trying to learn about all the finance side and the things that maybe you have to study. That's worthwhile, I think, as far as a pursuit. But the raw entrepreneur, the raw startup CEO, has to be someone who can, I think, solve a problem for a business and then recognize how opportunistic our pursuits really are.
I want to give our audience here an opportunity to have some questions as well, but maybe while people are thinking about that and raising their hand, Talk a little more, if you would, about in your book, you talked about shattering some of these myths. Or what are some of these other myths that you talk about in your book that you maybe not have mentioned yet?
And I know there was a question up front. One, Steve Jobs is, I think, the greatest entrepreneur around, and thank goodness that we still have him. I think he gets to say, I went to Reed College and studied fonts or studied you know, different languages, and that led to the Mac font. I think he gets to completely reverse engineer his career and say, everything happened because this is my plan from the beginning. The rest of us have a way of sort of revising history as far as what's really happened. Another myth about, I think, entrepreneurship is that my colleagues pursuing medicine or the law years ago get to focus and at the end of a good career, they're handed the keys of the kingdom, whereas we entrepreneurs are expected to have our eureka moment in the lab followed by a lifetime of pain. And I don't think that's the way it should go. I think that is a myth that entrepreneurship is this light bulb in the head followed by this certain kind of life. I think entrepreneurship can be every bit as much of a craft as the study of medicine or the law if we are that opportunistic and focused about it. And that can lead to a much easier existence. Yeah.
I lost you about the second question. Yeah. How I could be an entrepreneur if I'm getting a paycheck.
If you're getting a paycheck.
Yeah.
So you are at Google, and Google turns out these fantastic products every quarter. I believe there are entrepreneurs who are leading those product initiatives. Just because they're not responsible for keeping the lights on, they are saying, I want to put this in the field. I've got a vision for it. I'm building from scratch. Google's as entrepreneurial a culture as it gets, so they're going to – you're not buying it. I mean, I think that they can. You can be almost a startup CEO within one of those companies. You don't own it. I'm trying to be objective. I think I agree, but I'm just trying to say. I mean, there are millions out there who are in these companies. What should the suggestion be? Everyone quit and everyone will go do it themselves. So you know, I hear you, and I mean, look. I get credit for being an entrepreneur, but I have a couple of old college professors in the room. They know I couldn't do anything else. No one would hire me, and no one's going to put up with me, you know, quarter after quarter. Maybe that's the secret of being an entrepreneur. Oh, I'm sorry.
When you talk about to begin with an end in mind, are you talking about the business plan of a company or something else?
I'm talking about strategy, core strategy that – tactically, we are consumed with making our quarters, executing, doing all the things that are necessary to build a successful company. But we forsake the only strategy, the only thing that really matters. Remember the fly example? You're not going to start thinking about the fly the next time you see that. No one cares about that. But maybe that's how you win. You study and you adjust. Just that slight pivot in thinking. So when we're running our companies, we have to study and adjust to where we want to end up. So the thesis is isolate a cross-section of potential end games, of potential acquirers in a business case, and steer your company in their direction. Very opportunistic, but as a function of time, and it turns out a function of value, because time is value, it's your highest propensity option, rather than doing a good job and hoping someone notices. That's how I was trained. And we're all brainwashed to try to be insanely great and change the world. But then it takes, you know, 97 eggs to crack to get the one or two out of 100, in my view.
Hi, John. I just wanted to comment on the previous question. I was going to say, I assume the entrepreneurial types in Google get stock and other incentives besides a paycheck to increase the company services. So.
Provided the stock goes up, yeah. And Google just bought, you know, another company. It was announced today, all in stock. And that receives the same dollar value as if it was a cash deal, if the stock stays constant. But yes, but then, you know, you can be entrepreneurial, I believe, within a retail organization. My wife owns and operates two retail boutiques across the bridge, and she, I think, employs people who are fairly entrepreneurial. And so, again, they work for someone else. They're not responsible for keeping the lights on, but they are operating or doing a large part of the entrepreneur's task.
I had a question. So you spoke a lot about economic and financial structuring and timing. Can you speak to a little bit about how, in terms of business plan or product, how you're selecting the problem for a business to solve?
So I spoke a lot about that, and I can make a joke that the product doesn't matter. And that's not my opinion, but I can't stress that enough, and then I'll answer your question. I think of Sybase was a better database, at least at one time, than Oracle. And Oracle, at least in my opinion, was just a sales and marketing machine. I don't think there's no bigger genius than Larry Ellison, and as far as putting together a relational database, then putting together middleware applications on top of the database, and then becoming the most acquisitive or one of the most acquisitive companies in the world. Those are examples of three key strategic decisions that he and his team made over 33 plus years, in addition to many, many others that built an Oracle. So in terms of putting the right product together or putting the right mix together, maybe my feeling in the wake of admitting that I am not capable of making the quality of strategic decisions as an Ellison or as one of these guys or anywhere close, that I'm only given so much time to innovate. I only have a certain window to be able to put a product in the field. So that's why the economic analysis is so important to me, to make sure that I'm positioned in a certain way on a particular wave. Related to your question and to answer about the type of product, I've been an enterprise guy my whole life. I've looked at a big business. In Barossa's case, it was Wells Fargo. You know, when you log on to your online banking account, you see we're verifying your identity. That's partly our stuff. You see those pictures on the Bank of America site. That was our nemesis. That was our key competitor. They got acquired by RSA, but we battled together for a while. So solving a problem for a world-class organization like Wells, once you sign up a Wells Fargo, a Fortune 100 customer like that, your problems as an entrepreneur are going way down. They are paying you enough. You are learning from them because of how technologically discerning they are. And here's something. You know how you travel through the airports and you see all the orange Oracle signs? We're in 20 out of 20 of the top insurance companies and 20 out of 20 of the top finance guys. Oracle does so well, and especially during a downturn, because their whole model is about steadily clawing more and more into their 300,000 coveted customers. The reason they're doing these small acquisitions like mine and some other is it gets them more products and services into their key customers. So another answer to your question is, if you can sell your technology product to a Fortune 500 company, then I believe there is a Fortune 100 company out there who is interested in getting closer to that Fortune 500 company. And then you don't have to sign up 20 other guys. You've proven your strategic value. You've locked in a value of your company that is necessary that can then be replicated n number of times. So on the product side, my strategy is to build for synergy before I'm building for some, you know, illusory profit and loss goal. I am looking to build something that can be replicated n number of times within an acquirer so that they'll be more interested in me. So I want to build on the right platform. I want to be very conscious of the type of customers that I'm getting, so I'm not wasting time on the customers that are smaller or can't teach me enough technologically. I'd rather have 5 Wells Fargos than 50,000 unknown small businesses in a vacuum, as far as the quality of my technology, right? Because then I think a world-class acquirer will be more interested in plugging my technology into its entire apparatus rather than I can never build something with revenue sufficient to make a dent in any of those acquiring companies. Does it make sense?
A couple of questions come to mind. Talk a little bit about technology and entrepreneurship. In other words, is that the Holy Grail nowadays? And certainly it has been over the last couple of decades. We think of Silicon Valley and the entrepreneur and technology. But entrepreneurship, does it apply to non-technology areas as well? Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think the non-technology areas, I think the relevance today is they're starting to merge with the technology areas. Nissan's come out with an electric car very quickly because of a combination of policy response, stimulus, and who knows what's going on behind the scenes. I think some of these retail guys and some of these offline businesses, in order to survive, are literally in the car business and outside of the car business going to become hybrids. They're going to take advantage of some of the best technology that's available via acquisition or via some sort of partnership. And we're going to see some really interesting offline guys get competitive. In looking at these previous cycles, I've also looked at a lot of companies that flourished in those times. Now I think it's really the problem. I think some of our most storied companies have gone away, and not just in financial services. And for other companies that have been around for 50 or 100 years to reinvent themselves offline, they're going to have to leverage technology in different ways, not just by partnering, but by literally combining themselves with it. And I think the battery on the clean tech side is one of these fascinating cases why no one can solve that, and why the Chinese are so passionate about that, and why we're just starting to get our acts together, because the battery then powers everything. So I hope someone much more capable than I am, and by the way, someone with the training. Remember I said I dropped out of college. I finished to make my mother happy, but I don't have the training to do one of these advanced clean tech companies. So we need a generation of kids to actually stay in school, get advanced degrees, and not start the next Facebook so that they can build these technologies.
We've got a program coming up here next week called Does America Have a Future? And I was curious with regard to this issue of technology and entrepreneurship and just capitalism in general. In other words, capitalism has been on trial here over the last year or two. People are thinking that, gee, maybe that's not going to work anymore. There was an interesting article in the Financial Times just the other day about the Nordic model of capitalism. And as I read the article, they were talking about egalitarianism and some of these other things that characterize the Nordic quote-unquote model. But also in there I noticed they said that entrepreneurship is not so much alive and well in that model. That's really generally bigger companies, and and then the CEO doesn't make that much more than the guy on the shop floor, which here in the United States we've got this obscene kind of ratio and so forth. So I guess I'm curious about your perspectives on America and its future and entrepreneurship as it relates to sort of what we hold on to is that we're a nation of ideas and we can commercialize ideas. And boy, if there's anything going to take us, into the future, it's going to be our entrepreneurial spirit. What is your sense of that? And especially when you point out batteries as well in Asia, and the Chinese and others are well ahead of us right now in that particular area. But talk a little bit about your perspective as you've seen it with regard to entrepreneurship here in America and whether we're losing a bit of our edge in that regard, or maybe not. Anyway,
the finest venture capitalists out there are only 50 years old. The guys that formed the Fairchild Semiconductors on up, then the Genentechs and the Googles. We can't tax them to death so that they can't do their jobs, and we can't tax the entrepreneurs to death while forsaking them with policy response so they can't do their jobs. The future of this country, I think, is in a 20-mile square radius, whether it's Sand Hill Road or South San Francisco. So I think we have to let these entities, though it's painful because the condition we're in, everyone presumably has to pay more taxes, but I think we have to let these entities function. You mentioned the disparity between CEO pay and not. An interesting article surfaced today that the government ordered three $50 million jets, right? So they hauled these CEOs of the auto and related companies up and says, don't fly. And then the government itself, these congressmen, ordered the jets. Now, that's mostly name-calling and mostly nonsense. But if we have the government stepping in to run some of our most complicated companies, we're in for real trouble, I think. If the government can't get the cash for clunkers thing to work, so goes the news, how can we trust them to run General Motors and some of these other organizations? So I think step one is really stepping back. And by the way, I'm a fan of the administration, if that's not clear. But, this is how I show the love, right? You have to allow people to operate. And again, I think we're a very efficient market. I think we can get the job done if we're given just enough of a runway to be able to do that. So I would love to see massive policy response, maybe even the form of stimulus to encourage entrepreneurship. And I would love to see the government back away from some of these businesses so that entrepreneurs are encouraged about being entrepreneurial again. I mentioned my CFO's company. I sat out the Great Recession. I'm not on company number four yet, and it's been 2 years since I've been too spooked to push against the ocean. I'm aching to do it, but I'm not necessarily convinced. Maybe we've had that bottom in housing starts. I think we have. I'm not necessarily convinced that it's going to be smooth sailing. I hope this quarter. I hope next quarter. I think, but I'm not convinced. And I think some of the policy response that I'm seeing is a reason of that.
John, what thoughts would you, as we conclude here, what thoughts would you leave with us here tonight, especially the budding entrepreneurs in the audience? Anyway, just summarize a couple of key thoughts you'd like us to go and reflect upon tonight.
So, again, it was a real pleasure to be invited to speak by this caliber of forum. I've also had the pleasure to speak at 7 out of the 10 top business schools in the last year. And whether you're back east, whether you're just down the road, I am and have been alarmed at the number of current or future entrepreneurs that I'm meeting that don't understand a venture capital term sheet. They don't understand really what's waiting for them. They don't understand how to financially architect their company to make sure that because they're doing the technology and the product and all of these things so well, that they also hedge and protect themselves from getting clobbered by not having the savvy to finance the company in the right way. I know that financing is taught in business school, but I think it needs to be completely redesigned as far as the case study piece has always been big at Harvard on down, but it's case studies from A to Z, and it's about companies that are years old and not fully developed. I think the business school curriculum has to be rewired, and they have to bring in guys who are in progress, also guys that have created craters in the earth, and I've certainly created one, that can tell the real world people what happened. And the only difference between me and a CTO who's also been with me for many years, who's not here tonight, is that I have the financial training. And he's much smarter and has most of the rest of the training. But do not start a venture without the financial piece in mind. And this isn't a bank loan. This is sophisticated equity or debt financing so that you can not sell yourself down the river without knowing it and many years from now is a thought.
So can we put our hands together, please, for John Fisher? Okay. I want to thank John Fisher for sharing with us some thoughts on entrepreneurism and beginning with the end in mind, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.